From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is reporting in Mexico this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Throughout most of the uprising against Syrian strongman Bashar al-Assad, journalists have been on the outside looking in. While forces allied with Assad perpetrated one bloodbath after another, Syria kept its borders sealed, leaving the press to depend on secondhand accounts of atrocities in Homs and elsewhere. Now, though, a number of Western news organizations have been granted visas, but has the presence of reporters on the ground confirmed the outside's worst fears or made the situation murkier? Paul Danahar of the BBC says that as access has increased, so has the story's complexity. Paul, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
It must be very easy to report from Damascus because the narrative is so straightforward. Assad runs a brutal, oppressive regime, and the West is frustrated at every turn from protecting the good guys, the opposition rebels. Pretty simple, right?
The beginning it was unarmed protesters bravely standing up against men with guns. And it didn't work. What happened was the regime just cracked down even harder. And so some elements of the opposition turned to a military solution to their revolution. Then other regional players started sticking their finger in the pie. Countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, they actively began supporting the rebel groups with money and with arms. So that's complicated. It's also, we've seen jihadis, and they are answerable to no one. They have a lot of experience under their belt, and they are the ones that everyone believes are behind these big bomb attacks.
So based on what you're describing, even when the Assad regime makes these almost cartoonish accusations that the opposition is composed of terrorists and foreign agents, under the present circumstances, there is actually some truth in that.
Yeah, I think it's become a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. He talked about there being al-Qaeda elements in Syria last year, and I think now there are al-Qaeda elements, but they've managed to worm their way into the structure of society because the society has become completely chaotic. His claim that the other governments are fiddling around in his backyard, they're also true. He's created the environment for the kind of things he warned about happening to actually happen. So I think we could have probably said that at the beginning, most of what the government said wasn't true and most of what the opposition said was true. And now I think we have to say most of what the government says may not be true, but some of it now probably is. And most of what the opposition have said in the past was true, but some of it now probably isn't.
This gets to the propaganda war that in your piece you said was now fully underway, where you can't trust the people whom the press utterly depended on in the early days of the uprising, the citizens of Homs and the rebels themselves.
But some of the claims they've made about the numbers of deaths or what's been going on has sometimes been exaggerated. And to be honest with you, I think that's not necessarily an unreasonable thing to assume. The problem that we've got is at the beginning, because we saw the conflict completely in black and white, good guy, bad guy terms, we're having to do a bit of a handbrake turn and say, hang on, we tend to be a little bit more sophisticated and maybe cynical when it comes to information that we get from people that are not people that we know. And we're just reapplying the old standards we should have always applied on all the information we get out of Syria now.
This inability to know what is coming from whom and why gets quite dizzying. There was even a charge from a British journalist that the anti-government forces lured him into what is essentially an ambush, which he believes was done in order to create a furor that a Western journalist was hurt or killed by Assad-loyal militias. Do you think that's true?
I spoke to someone who was actually there at the time. They certainly believe that it was true. But I think the key thing here is that because there's no command and control structure within the opposition, the guys you might be working with are completely random. It's like going into a bar and asking the first guy you see to kind of look after you while you go into a war zone. You just simply don't know what you're getting.
One final question, Paul. Before the press were gradually invited back into Syria by the Assad regime, the trajectory was just a gathering storm of indignation at the murderousness of Assad's attacks on innocent civilians and toward some sort of international intervention. Now there are all those journalists there portraying the situation in all of its complexity. Is it possible that truth itself, truth about the complexity of the situation, is being made a stooge of by Assad in order to take the momentum out of Western action?
I do think that the government has begun to realize that putting in more foreign journalists may show just how messy it is, and it may make people think, let's not go there. But the other thing that it would also do is it would allow people to think about the problem of the day after, so that when people really do have to think about how they're going to solve the mess that's in Syria, they've thought about it before, rather than suddenly being surprised by what they find when the conflict starts spilling out into other parts of the region.
Paul, many thanks.
You're welcome.
Paul Danahar is the Middle East Bureau Chief for the BBC. As he just told us, there is a propaganda war being waged right alongside the bloody fighting, and it is more sophisticated than dubious pronouncements by the two sides. The New York Times reported this week that the Assad family employs Western PR firms to polish its image for the rest of the world, especially Asma al-Assad, Syria's first lady. Paris Match magazine called her an Eastern Diana. Vogue praised her thin physique and great clothes. And the Huffington Post, never one to miss an opportunity to put together a slideshow, created one called Asma al-Assad, Syria's First Lady and All-Natural Beauty. At OTM, we couldn't help but wonder, who in the West would be willing to take on the repugnant job of pitching PR stories about a dictator's wife to fashion magazines? We turned to Harper's contributing editor Ken Silverstein, who back in 2007 went undercover to investigate two PR firms that try to help dictators win friends and influence people. His cover was that he was working on behalf of the sociopathic government of Turkmenistan.
The longtime dictator had died, and he had been replaced in power by his personal dentist. And I said, you know, it's a new era for Turkmenistan, and we really need some help making sure that people are aware of the important changes going on over there, the emerging democracy. Things aren't perfect, but it's really getting better, and can you help us out?
This is a country that was so repressive, it had banned video games, car radios, opera, ballet, long hair on men. This is going to be a tough case for any PR firm. Did they turn you down?
Not only did they not turn me down, they were falling all over themselves to win the contract. And in fact, because it was such a horrible dictatorship, they were saying that they'd have to charge me more. See, they love these contracts. You know, if you're lobbying for, I don't know, Canadian sheep farmers or something, you know, you can't really charge a premium. But if you're lobbying for a corrupt, thuggish dictatorship, then you make more money because it's a tough client. In fact, Cassidy and Associates, one of the lobbying firms I approached, which wanted to charge me $5 million over 3 years, they actually said to me, you know, we'd actually have to charge you more if something bad happened. I'm paraphrasing there, but that's essentially what they said. You know, if Human Rights Watch comes out with a negative report or, you know, and again, it was unstated, but it was clearly implied that, you know, if unarmed protesters were shot down or something, they might have to jack up their prices. So they love these clients. The dirtier, the better. It's much more lucrative.
So what did they say they could do for sure?
APCO specifically said they would write and place op-eds in American newspapers. And what they'd do is that a staffer at APCO would write it. Then they'd go out and recruit an academic or somebody at a think tank to put their name on it. And then they would go place it in an American newspaper so it would look like some independent thinking human being as opposed to a paid flack for a dictatorship. They said that that would be very simple. Another thing that was quite interesting is that they promised both the firms that they would keep everything under the radar. If you're lobbying, if you're going to Capitol Hill as a lobbyist or if you're meeting with executive branch officials, you have to disclose that. But both of the firms talked about how the work they did would in part be public relations, and that they don't actually have to disclose.
These firms are vying for your business. What did they tell you about their successes for, you know, other brutal dictators?
I think the funniest thing was that Cassidy told me that they represented the government of Equatorial Guinea, which really is one of the worst regimes on the planet, just a horrible, corrupt, thuggish dictatorship. And they said, with Equatorial Guinea, for years, they were on the top 10 list of Parade magazine's worst dictators in the world, the President Obiang, and we got them off that list. And so this was this big achievement that they touted. It was funny because I went home and checked. He was off the top 10. He was then ranked at number 11. So this was Cassidy's great achievement, was they knocked him down to number 11 on the world's worst dictators list.
I'm wondering whether these tactics ever really do any good for the clients who are paying big dollars to burnish their reputations. If I read a slideshow about Asma El Assad's pretty red dress, right up against a story about the Syrian army using 8-year-olds as human shields, is that really going to soften Syria's image for me? I mean, even if it's a super pretty dress.
Well, I mean, maybe if you're trying to persuade 14-year-old boys with hormonal problems, you might win them over. But no, of course not. I mean, this is the dirty secret of lobbying, which is that most of it is a total scam. These lobbyists will tell the countries that they can make great achievements and that they can really impact public opinion and political opinion. And in some cases, they can achieve real results. But for the most part, when you're dealing about a thuggish regime like Syria, which is currently employing brutal violence against demonstrators, that is just not going to fly. They really can't achieve a lot in a terrible situation. And they don't like to acknowledge that because that would mean they wouldn't get their big fat checks.
All right, Ken, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Ken Silverstein is a contributing editor for Harper's and a fellow at the Open Society Foundations. Coming up, filming the police filming you. It's legal, and gosh, just everyone is doing it. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. In April, after the arrest of a dozen protesters for obstructing the flow of traffic at an Occupy Minnesota demonstration in Minneapolis, the occupiers posted videos on YouTube which showed several of them apparently being roughed up by the police. To view the tape, you'd gather that the police simply moved in and commenced arresting protesters without warning. But there was another camera rolling that night, one belonging to the police themselves. And in response to the protesters' video, the Minnesota Police Department posted around 20 minutes of raw footage on its new YouTube channel. On that video, you can clearly see the police delivering several warnings by bullhorn.
If you fail to remove the obstructions on the plaza, the Minneapolis Police Department will take enforcement action. I want to thank you in advance for your cooperation.
Incoming Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Harteau says that MPD's new YouTube channel was originally meant as a repository of raw footage to shine a light on police work, but after the Occupy incident, they realized they could use the channel to level the playing field.
It never occurred to us at the time to be proactive. We tend to be reactive to somebody that comes forward and either makes accusations or you see small news clips on television because they have a short period of time. And here we had a 20-minute or so video that could show the entire story.
Well, not the entire story. Multiple video points of view are better than fewer, and raw footage is better than edited footage. But your camera person's fairly close-up perspective did obscure some of the things that did come out on some Occupy video. For example, an officer knocking down one of the protesters and the camera going to the street. And I think some of that just had to do with the close-up vantage. Who was shooting this for you?
Our crime lab videographers were out at the scene.
And there's the problem. They have a kind of close-up mentality.
Correct.
Did you ask them subsequently to do a little more pullback to reveal?
The pullback, but also to try to have multidimensional. Cameras will tell the story of what they see. And so the more dimensions we have and the more cameras we have, obviously we can get a better picture of all the scenarios as to what's happened.
This all makes very good sense to add perspective to what is almost by definition a chaotic situation. But I'm wondering how long your efforts at radical transparency will last. For example, what happens if your police cameras capture your officers violating departmental policy or possibly even the law, making your video evidentiary and perhaps prohibiting you from posting it routinely online?
When things are evidence, yes, we will have to withhold that. But we will certainly deal with any video that shows misconduct of any kind, just as we would if a citizen brought that video in. The incident you discussed about the camera man was brought before Internal Affairs and isn't being dealt with.
Tell me about your own ranks. Are there officers grumbling about having Big Brother looking over their shoulder while they're trying to go about their business?
Officers have always been a little bit hesitant with video, but that documentation has saved officers more often than not from frivolous accusations. I'm very proud of the officers here and their work, and we need to be able to show what they do. And officers should assume, frankly, that they're always being videotaped. There's fixed cameras throughout the city. There's squad cameras that people may not know that are running. I mean, the technology is there, and so the assumption should be made that they're under surveillance.
As you look at video of the Occupy protests, everybody's got a cell phone, and they're all taking pictures of the police work in progress. How has this changed police work in Minneapolis?
When you see that people are using cameras, there are times that it actually interferes with an officer's ability to do their job. I realize that people want to see what occurred, and they want to document that. But police also have a job to do, and their goal is to facilitate and support freedom of speech, protect people's rights, and keep them safe. So it does become more challenging. It also becomes challenging when it comes to going to court, because the concern is an officer's word doesn't mean as much as it used to if it doesn't have corroborating video or DNA. And that's unfortunate, because there are going to be times that the camera didn't work, or the camera didn't capture that view, or the camera is facing forward, but what occurred is behind you. So it's a tool, but it's not a guarantee. It's not a fix. It's not an end-all.
All right. Chief, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chief Janae Hartaux is the incoming chief of police for the city of Minneapolis. It's actually legal to film the police, but you might not know that since people are arrested for doing it all the time, particularly during the height of last year's Occupy protests. But that police practice may be on the way out. The Connecticut Senate recently passed a bill that would make it illegal for cops to arrest or otherwise interfere with citizens who film them, provided the citizens aren't themselves interfering in police business. Mickey Osterreicher is general counsel for the National Press Photographers Association. He supports photographers he believes are wrongfully arrested and gives seminars to police on First and Fourth Amendment rights.
The First Amendment is not absolute. It's subject to reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. So would it be reasonable for an officer to say to you, if you were standing 3 feet away while you were filming, can you please move back 10 feet? Or during a demonstration, if you were out in the street, can you please get up on the sidewalk and film? That's a reasonable time, place, and manner restriction. Can he tell you to just stop doing what you're doing? Can they then seize your phone? They do have a right to seize equipment if they believe that you have recorded evidence of a crime for a very short duration, but they certainly have no right to look at it without a proper subpoena or warrant, and they never, ever, ever have the right to destroy the images that are on that phone or camera.
None of this talk is hypothetical. There have been a number of cases where citizen video has caught police in varying degrees of mischief, from roughing up a 14-year-old skateboarder in Baltimore to the shooting in the back of a handcuffed guy on a subway platform in Oakland, a young man named Oscar Grant. This video can reveal a lot, including the most abject police brutality.
I mean, recordings obviously are much better than eyewitness testimony. And officers realize that, and many of them are fearful, even though, you know, from my point of view, they shouldn't be. Because if there's a claim of use of excessive force or police brutality, and the video shows that they acted in a manner to effectuate an arrest as comports with their training, then that will help support their position that they didn't do anything wrong.
You go to workshops with police. What kind of reception do you get? Did the police report to you that they've had the scales fall from their eyes and now, aha, I get it?
They're pretty skeptical at first. I mean, the look that I'm used to is, who is this guy and why are we going to have to sit here for a couple hours and listen to him? I try and engage them in a dialogue and a conversation. And really, at the end of that, I've had officers come up to me and ask me different questions about certain scenarios. I have found, at least in the departments that I dealt with, that the top people are very interested in having proper training for their officers and guidelines.
Tell me about the back and forth between the Baltimore Police Department and the Department of Justice over a 2010 case in which cops confiscated a man's camera and erased its contents. The DOJ sent a letter outlining what it took to be Baltimore's dubious behavior. Baltimore rewrote its policy, and then the DOJ wrote again. Why did they have to double back to make their point?
The first time that the Department of Justice intervened back in January, they entered what is called a statement of interest. And basically, the Department of Justice talked about the right of citizens to record, that those rights are consistent with the First Amendment, that citizens have the right to be secure against unreasonable search and seizure. And they basically just sat back to see what the department would do.
In response, the Baltimore police said, yes, we've reviewed our policies. We are giving new instructions to our cops. We promise you everything's going to be all better now. And then what happened?
They issued a press release letting everybody know that they'd implemented these new guidelines and done training since back in November. And I think that was on a Thursday or a Friday in February. And literally Saturday night, there's this video that ended up on YouTube of somebody who was recording about six officers gathered around a person who was lying on the ground. You can see one of the officers looks up and in one fluid motion reaches for her handcuffs, comes up to the photographer, and she and the other officers end up moving the guy down the street, up kind of an alley, continuing to threaten him with arrest for loitering.
Walk down the street.
All right. You guys do know you have a standing order to allow people to record it. I'm leaving. I haven't...
Sir,
what?
How many times?
I'm leaving.
Turn around and walk.
I'm leaving.
Turn around and walk. Give me your ID.
And the Department of Justice says, no, really, you're not doing this right, and wrote another letter to the Baltimore police.
Right. And this one is almost a step-by-step connect-the-dots guideline of what they want to see as policies and what they want to see articulated in those policies. And as far as I know, the Department of Justice has not heard back from the Baltimore police since that letter.
You believe that there's something else at work here, and that is just the culture of policing. What happens when cops get their game face on? No matter what the law says, what will it take to defeat that culture?
It really is something that's cultural. I can't tell you how many times our members in the NPPA have told me of officers coming up to them and putting their hands over their lens. One of the things that I talk about all the time is we see this video coming out of the Arab Spring, most recently out of Syria. People are risking their lives to record tanks in the street and soldiers killing civilians. And they do this mostly on cell phones. And we look at what we see and think, how heroic. And yet those same actions on the streets in the United States are looked at as suspect. And I have a real problem with that. And that's the type of culture I'm trying to change.
Mickey, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Mickey Osterreicher is general counsel for the National Press Photographers Association.
Hello. This is the Minneapolis police. The party is over with. Grab your stuff and go, and then nobody goes to jail.
And what don't you do?
The few weeks ago, Pastor Mack Wolford, a Pentecostal preacher from West Virginia whose worship services included the handling of poisonous serpents, was bitten by a yellow timber rattlesnake. Wolford suffered for hours before he finally allowed emergency services to be notified, but by then it was too late. Wolford died from the bite. The religious belief that underlies Wolford's snake-handling practice and his willingness to die as a result is one thing. The religious belief that kept his family and congregants from calling emergency services on his behalf is another. But there was a third person whose beliefs were tested that day, and that's photojournalist Lauren Pond, who had been documenting Pastor Wolford's ministry and who watched him die.
I've been working on a documentary project about Pentecostal serpent handling for a little over a year now. I met Mack Wolford in May of 2011 at a religious service in Panther Park near Jolo, West Virginia. The practice of Pentecostal serpent handling is part of a larger tradition called signs following. And Mack was the first pastor who really opened up to me about it. There's a verse in the King James Bible. It's Mark chapter 16, verses 17 to 18. Essentially, it says if you're a true believer that you'll be able to take up serpents, drink any deadly thing, lay hands on the sick, and they shall recover. Signs following faith is based on these signs of true belief. You know, you see in Pentecostal churches often people speaking in tongues and laying hands on the sick, but they don't handle snakes or drink poison or handle fire. And this particular sect of Pentecostalism does.
It's dangerous. Mack Wolford's own father, himself a Pentecostal minister, died from a rattlesnake bite.
I believe it was when Mack was 15.
So nobody was under any illusions about how risky this practice is, nor were you. Did you give any thought before you began taking pictures as to what you would do in the event that he would be bitten?
When I first heard about this practice and when I first started photographing it, the thought had crossed my mind, well, what if something happens? But I never thought I would encounter it. I did actually witness another bite in January at a church in Tennessee. I was a young pastor. He turned pale and he was sick for a couple of hours, I think, but then he got better. I've heard stories of people getting bitten and getting better, so I honestly didn't think I would see it.
Okay, so let's go to May 27th. You were invited by Mack Wolford. He asked you to come down to West Virginia. Tell me about the events of that day.
I didn't see the bite happen. People were praying for him that he'd been bitten. And so that's when it got my attention. He wanted the service to go on, even after he'd been bitten. But it ground to a halt, I'd say, within 20 minutes, because then he wasn't able to stand by himself. Everyone was praying for him and taking care of him. He was visibly ill.
Was there talk in the congregation of calling for help?
No, not that I heard. Even if someone had tried to call, we were out in a place where there was no cell phone reception, so we wouldn't have been able to call right away. No one said anything about getting medical attention. And my understanding of this belief system is that practitioners do not want medical treatment. They believe it is the ultimate act of faith, really. You trust in God at this point, and he'll either take you or he'll heal you.
There was a gathering tragedy, and you continued to take pictures, and you did not attempt to get help. Did you consider the possibility of trying to intervene to save the guy's life?
The next day, I definitely had a pang of guilt. Why didn't I call somebody? But at the time, no, it wasn't a strong thought that stuck in my mind. I think it's an important part of the faith that not everyone gets to see or witness, and it was instinct. I just kept going, if something's happening, you know, I'm not going to try and stop it. Doing so and calling the paramedics would have undermined everything that he stood for and everything that I knew about him. My responsibility as a journalist is to show things in as complete and accurate way as possible. And if I'd seen someone get shot, I would call the ambulance for that person because they were intended to get shot. And obviously, I'd think they'd want medical help. Here, I knew he didn't want medical attention, and his whole family knew that. And this was the way I believe that he wanted to die. Obviously, there are going to be people who disagree with me, but I'm okay with that.
All right. So I understand the journalistic impulse and also understand the rationale that you are an invited guest witnessing somebody else's belief system. I got to tell you, if I'm in your position, I say, get out of the way. I'm finding a phone. Because for me, my human responsibility trumps my journalistic responsibility in this set of circumstances. Now that you've had the time to think this over, would you do today what you did on May 27th?
Yes, I'd say so. as a journalist, the question is, like, when are you a fly on the wall and when are you a human being? When do you intervene and when do you just watch and document? I think you just have to assess the situation. For me, it was never just a photo opportunity. I really wanted to show, and I think a lot of journalists want to show the complete story, you know, help people understand something like this better. This faith that had been, for lack of a better word, sensationalized. One of the most touching emails I got said something to the effect of, I dismissed the death of the West Virginia pastor as simply a Darwinian process. And your piece painted his actions and his those of his family and following in a more human way. It wasn't just a senseless death. He died doing something he truly believed in.
Lauren, thank you very, very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Lauren Pond is a freelance photographer focusing on religion. Her photo essay on the life and death of Mack Wolford appeared in the Washington Post. Coming up, the Heat versus the Thunder is an NBA final and a grammatical nightmare. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. The NBA Finals between the Miami Heat and the Oklahoma City Thunder are going on this week and next. The Heat and Thunder are singular because they have reached the championship series. But they're also singular because they're not plural. And for copy editors, that presents a very serious challenge. If the Celtics were facing the Spurs, headline writing would be a snap. But as Deadspin editor Tom Skoka recently wrote, these finals present a number agreement nightmare. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Tom, there was a time this was really not a problem. Teams were plurals. The Phillies, the Mets, the Braves, the Falcons, the Rangers, and so forth. And it corresponded with American grammatical tradition.
What happened, I think, was that people wanted something that sounded a little different, a little fresh, when the NBA was expanding in the late 80s. And so we ended up with the Miami Heat and the Orlando Magic. You know, and now the Thunder, as a newly renamed franchise, decided to do the same kind of thing. The problem is that what makes these names sound fresh or exciting to the people who name them is that they actually don't fit the grammar that we're used to using in America when we talk about sports.
They're mass nouns.
Right, which means that they denote an uncountable quantity.
And because it can't be broken down into its parts, it's confusing, right? Because teams, by definition, are a collection of individuals. Must be maddening to try to write around that.
So you can talk about who the most valuable Yankee is, because the Yankees break up into one Yankee after another. But these teams are an undifferentiated mass. You can't break off a piece of the Heat and talk about it, because one piece of Heat is Heat.
Who's the most valuable Heat?
One peal of thunder, you know, one calorie of Heat. I don't know how you would do that.
But there is another grammatical tradition for plurals that figures into this. Tell me about it.
In Britain, there's a longstanding habit of treating collective nouns or these kind of mass nouns as plurals. So in British English, you would say the team are doing well. And therefore, in British English, they don't really care what they call their sports teams. And so you have people say Arsenal are the superior side in this match.
But the problem is, as you observed, if you use the British convention, you sound like a poncy
rock critic. Yes. It's a longstanding problem in writing and talking about rock music, because so many bands have these names that are singular to describe this collective unit that's the band. And, you know, there's a lot of anglophilia in rock writing. And so there are people who will say things like Pavement are the most important band since Wire.
And how does that make you feel when you run across Pavement are the greatest band since Wire?
Despite the fact that I might agree with the sentiment, the skin crawls on the back of my neck. It's just, it's a...
And you basically want to find the critic and just kind of slap him around.
Yeah.
Come on.
Give him a wedgie, something.
You've got some examples illustrating the issue.
Right. Sports Illustrated pretty consistently embraces the British usage. So their headline would be, Heat have experience motivation to win it all.
Ponzi.
Yeah, extremely. I have another crumpet, Sports Illustrated. Whereas the hometown papers for these teams have just embraced the whole newspeak behind having a team that has a name like this. And they are singular. So the Daily Oklahoman says, the Thunder is the team America loves to love. The Heat is the team America loves to see lose. The Miami Herald, if the Heat loses a game, don't say the Heat lacks the will to win. Please don't say the Heat lacks the will to win, because it sounds terrible. Say the Heat lack the will. Sentence by sentence, it really depends on what you're saying, which sounds absurd.
So at Deadspin, you're not sticking to a single rule. You're giving everything the ear test.
Yeah, which means that we just have to keep thinking about this when we would probably rather stop.
Well, Godspeed, Tom Skoka. Godspeed.
Thank you very much.
Tom Skoka is the editor of Deadspin. Mad Men's fifth season ended this month. One of the reasons people love the show is because it so meticulously recreates the world of Manhattan in the 1960s. A lot of this is actually achieved through sound and language. When Mad Men old phones ring, like really ring as opposed to chirp, dress shoes click, typewriters clack.
Darcy's out.
Says who? Arthur's girl told me on the QT. She said he was in his office crying.
And the language is different, or at least it's supposed to be. While costumes and set decorations are dead on, verbal anachronisms sneak in with surprising frequency. We just don't notice them because to us, most modern speech doesn't sound modern. It just sounds like how people talk. And it's not as if Mad Men fans are equipped with some magic algorithm to spot the mistakes. But Benjamin Schmidt is. He's a visiting graduate fellow at Harvard's Cultural Observatory and part of the group that worked to develop a searchable database of around 5 million books Google has scanned. He takes every Mad Men script, isolates every single phrase, feeds those phrases into his program, and compares them to the period language from his Google Books database. What you're about to hear is an excerpt from the podcast I co-host with former OTM producer Mike Volo called Lexicon Valley. Mikey, take it away.
Something that Schmidt's data shows is not just areas in which we're bad at capturing the language of the past, but some areas in which we're actually pretty good. It turns out that the language of technology is something that we tend to get right, with one exception that proves the rule. That's language around the use of the phone, possibly because the phone seems to us like one of those eternal entities. And so we don't imagine that the language we use to describe the way we deal with the phone has changed. Here's Ben Schmidt.
Two episodes ago, Don Draper said that they couldn't leave the representative from Jaguar on hold.
Roger Sterling's office.
I want all the partners here.
You can't leave them on hold. Where's Pete?
It turns out, looking at this huge database of texts, that people almost never said on hold back then. There were hold buttons on phones, but the only way that they used the word hold was to say, could you hold the line, please? People hadn't been spending so much time on hold. The hold button wasn't so ingrained in popular consciousness that there was this idea of this state that somebody could be in, which was being on hold. That doesn't seem to really emerge until the 1970s.
More.
You love this.
Yeah, I do.
There's an episode of Mad Men in which the office gets a Xerox machine for the first time, and it's a big deal. And nothing about the way they talk about it jumps out in the data as strikingly anachronistic. So again, they're pretty good at getting technology right. But then when somebody gets on the phone again, something does jump out.
I just got off the line with X. This appears so often in the show, but it appears almost never in the actual printed texts from the era. Sometimes they're starting to say, try to get X on the line, try to get Lee Garner on the line. But again, it's about this state of talking on the phone where you wouldn't necessarily think, I was on the line with him, now I'm off the line with him.
So the language around technology, social change, with the exception of the phone, is consistently time appropriate in Mad Men. Unlike the language of business, which the show consistently gets wrong and inserts phrases that are far too modern for the time.
Well, this is doubly shocking for me, Mike, because I'm well informed on the history of advertising and the agency business in the 60s. And, you know, I thought I knew the jargon pretty well. I would go so far as to say I would imagine I'm an expert in this subject. And I have seldom winced at any kind of terminology that comes from the character's mouth. So this is going to be really ugly for me in the next minute, I'm suspecting.
Prepare to wince.
So there are all these terms like deal breaker, which doesn't appear until the 1970s, using to leverage as a verb, using phrases like level the playing field, or having Don Draper get a signing bonus, or telling somebody to keep a low profile at a meeting.
Do you talk about television?
I have a meeting on the books.
You talked a lot about radio and Kinsey.
You're going to have to keep a low profile on this, but it doesn't mean you're not working.
None of those were phrases that were used in any significant rate in the early 1960s. And some of them, that's actually really sort of culturally significant. Leverage is my favorite example on this one, because nowadays, investment bankers, hedge fund guys, that's sort of the highest glamour point in American business. And the language of high finance trickles down into sort of all of our common vocabularies all the time. But back in the 1960s, finance banking was not a particularly glamorous sector. And in fact, the most glamorous sector was advertising. But having them using all of this language from the 1970s and the 1980s, when we moved from the sort of consumer capitalism towards more financial capitalism more recently, doesn't really get the business environment right.
Aha, finally, he mentions a term that I did recognize as having been out of place.
What's that?
And that is leverage, which is continues to be a bete noire for me, because in the modern era, it comes out of the mouth of advertising people about every 6.5 seconds. When they mean to say take advantage of or exploit, they say leverage, and it makes me cringe.
So Schmidt, as part of his dissertation, unrelated to Mad Men, does research on the advertising industry in the 1940s and 50s. So he's a bit of an expert as well at this point. And when his algorithm suggested that focus group, which is used in Mad Men, was anachronistic, he thought that must be a mistake, because he was sure that he had seen the term focus group in these obscure trade magazines that he had hard copies of and were not in his database. So he went back to the magazines to check and prove his algorithm wrong. And in fact, he found the phrase focused interview, focused group interview, but he couldn't find anywhere in these magazines from the 40s and 50s focus group as its own standalone noun phrase.
He probably would have had to look at the trade publications beginning in the mid to late 70s to locate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's in fact when it starts to show up, I think, in the database. And so it may be that this sloppiness with regard to business language, more so than in other areas, is particular to our time, or maybe there's something universal going on here. Schmidt found an interesting piece of evidence. He put the full text of Edith Wharton's novel, The Age of Innocence, through his algorithm. The Age of Innocence was written around 1920 and is set in the 1870s. In other words, it's purporting to capture the way things were a half century earlier, just like Mad Men. And the database shows an apparent anachronism in the following sentence.
Dr. Carver is a very clever man. He wants a rich wife to finance his plans, and Medora is simply a good advertisement as a convert.
So Edith Wharton pulled a Matthew Weiner, huh? One man's leverage is another woman's finance.
Yeah, exactly. To finance as a verb used colloquially in this way didn't emerge until later, the 1880s and 1890s, I think, really for sure. Edith Wharton in the 1920s wouldn't have necessarily known that. So why would we be so careful with the language of technology and social change and get that right more often than not, but not business? Schmidt has a theory. Here it is.
We have these really strong ingrained narratives of progress in technology. The technology is always advancing, and that helps us remember that technology is always really deeply historical. And we have that same idea for race relations and for gender relations, that we're on this upward slant and it may be interrupted and it may go from side to side, but that one of the things that's really defining about 20th century America is that we've had a really progressive, forward-moving narrative about social change. And for the most part, we don't have that about business. In fact, we tend to think that a lot of business language is eternal, and a lot of the ways that our culture talks about business is that they're sort of eternal facts of capitalism or eternal facts about the ways that corporations work that makes it really hard to realize that, in fact, business organization, business language changed dramatically in the last 50 years. CFO, chief financial officer, is used at one point in Mad Men. But in fact, businesses didn't even have CFOs until the early 1970s that they called CFOs.
I think it would have been even more jarring if they had referred to the chief privacy officer.
Yes, exactly. At least they don't have an IT guy.
You mentioned progress in society that we do have a pretty good timeline on. I noticed that black people in Mad Men are referred to as Negroes, which is supposed to sound jarring, but was very much the terminology of the day. And if they said African American or even black in the episodes that take place in 1964, that would make you flinch.
That would be entirely incongruous. And of course, they don't make those mistakes, right? I mean, there's no fax machine in Mad Men. This timeline that we have for technology and for social change is very deeply ingrained in our consciousness.
Still, it shocks me that no one was ever told to keep a low profile in a meeting. That just seems as timeless as can be.
Well, maybe they had some other way of expressing that idea. Like with a lot of these things, it's not that the sentiment didn't exist. It's just that the words we use to describe that sentiment were different.
Okay, fair enough. But Schmidt, in his research, is using all of these countless millions of books, which are, of course, written speech reflecting spoken language, but nonetheless written. Is he sure that they are a fair representation of contemporaneous language for the times in which the various books were written?
That occurred to me, and it occurred to him. He's done a few things so far to convince himself that that's the case. First, he ran some scripts from early 20th century plays and radio shows to determine whether or not the dialogue in those would map closely to books from that time period. And they did. He did the same thing with movie scripts from the 60s, and he found a similar close mapping to books from that time. But that's still written material for the most part, right? It's not candid, off-the-cuff dialogue, which is really hard to get, right? Recordings from the 1960s, who has those? And it's even harder to get transcripts of that stuff. But there is one such body of work. Can you guess what that might be?
The Congressional Record? Am I warm?
You're actually really warm. I mean, the Congressional Record is probably not quite as conversational as he was looking for, but you might remember that Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon recorded many, many hours in the White House of meetings and conversations with them and their aides. A lot of that stuff has been transcribed. He took all of it and ran it through his algorithm and checked it against the database. And those conversations map very closely to the printed material from that time. So he feels pretty good that the database is large enough that it does approximate the way people would have used language in that time, with the exception of one category of words that he's had to, in fact, take out of his data set. And those are swear words, right? I mean, people from the early 20th century and people in the 1960s cursed maybe as much as we do now, but they didn't print it very much.
So if we want to know whether the profanity in, say, Downton Abbey is historically accurate,
we're out of luck.
Yeah, I'll say 1960 for that one.
I'll have to check the database.
For more information about where to listen to the unedited version of this and many other Lexicon Valley episodes, go to onthemedia.org.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurkhman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Eliza Novick-Smith and Amy DiPiero. And our show was edited this week by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was John Delore. Ellen Horn is WNYC's Senior Director of National Programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week with a special on Mexico. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.